Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Sally Cohn, one of the leading progressive voices in America. A frequent guest on CNN, MSNBC and Fox News, Sally is a popular keynote speaker, including most recently with the Forgiveness Project here in the UK, talking about political division, hate, otherizing, diversity and identity, and how we can solve the deep problems of our past and present. Her first book, The Opposite of Hate, came out last year, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Well, hello, Sally. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, well, perhaps you could begin by telling us a bit about your background and how you became interested in the whole notion of hatred.
Sure. I think as a human being, I'm interested in hatred. I hope all of us are. I hope anyone who's paying attention right now sees the crisis of rising hatred in our world. My particular experience was spending the first 16 years of my career as a community organizer and working against hatred, anti-LGBT bias, hatred in the criminal justice system, anti-immigrant hatred, and then having the experience of becoming a television commentator and going to work at Fox News, which in the United States is the sort of bastion of, right-wing kind of conservative, well, for lack of a better word, hate, and realizing that these people who I had been working against my entire life, who I had thought of as completely and totally hateful, were, yes, sometimes that, but also sometimes not, and sometimes kind and funny and personable and caring, and also coming to terms with the fact that, a lot of what was going on for me was that I hated them, that in thinking I was the brave fighter against hate, that in fact I had internalized quite a lot of hatred against my enemies, and that is what led me to want to understand the phenomenon of hate more broadly and how we all, to some extent, not necessarily all equally, but all demean and dehumanize people because of who they are or what they believe.
Sure. Well, the term hatred itself encompasses a broad range of attitudes and behaviors. What would you say your best shot at a rough definition of it is?
Well, yeah. So you can tell even there, I'm alluding to a broader definition than most people would, right? So a lot of people think of hatred as something that's overt, that you intentionally, deliberately feel negative, condescending, dehumanizing views towards a group of people, and that is overt, that is deliberate. I happen to think hate is broader, because when we have an unconscious bias, whether it's unconscious racial bias or misogyny, or if those aren't sort of playing at the top of our overt mind frame and actions and behavior, and yet are still there, carried out, influencing our choices, who we hire, who we associate with, what we believe about people, if those things are at the level of our unconscious, well, they were still put there by hate. It was the same origins of history and habit that inculcated them into our minds, and then they're just manifesting in different ways. And look, I don't concern myself as much with if you hate your ex-girlfriend or your ex-boyfriend or your old neighbor, like that individual level where you have an actual excuse and whatever. I don't think it's good, but doesn't worry me. What bothers me is, again, that systemic, those trends, that history in the past or habits in the present of demeaning and dehumanizing groups of people because of who they are or what they believe. That tends to be my operational definition.
Well, you mentioned biases there, which, to a large extent are part of our evolutionary makeup. But how would you see hate in relation to the whole nature and nurture thing?
It's a great question. Someone recently said to me, this sort of nature-nurture debate when it comes to hate or anything for that matter is like asking, when it comes to a rectangle, what's more responsible for the area of the rectangle, the length or the width? And I thought that was just such a perfect illustration, because of course you can have people, and we know this in research, we know it with twin studies, but we certainly have all kinds of evidentiary and anecdotal evidence across the board of people who grew up in one context and became one way and grew up in another context and became another. And you know, in my book, there are people who were exposed to the most hateful of hateful ideas along the lines of sort of neo-Nazism and chose that path. And there were people who were exposed to it. And that was a wake-up call to them to fight harder against those forces in our world. So it's hard to know. What I think is more important is always my guiding principle is, look, whatever it is that produced us up until this point, the sort of nature argument of things, then here we are. And we as individuals, and more importantly, as a society, make certain choices to condone or condemn certain kinds of beliefs and behaviors. And that is what has, it seems to me, a far more profound impact on us, because that's the piece we can control. And so to me, the question is, well, what are we doing in the sense of discouraging, helping people see and understand and thus counter those kinds of conscious and unconscious forms of hatred?
Well, that makes a lot of sense. To what degree was that, or was there another fundamental question that you wished to explore when you first embarked on writing the book?
My goal was to end hate. My goal is still to end hate. My goal is to do something about the dynamic that I continually notice in these conversations, which is that we all say we're against hate, but then what we mean is we're against their hate. The group that we think does it worse. And look, I happen to think there is a group in our world that does it worse, that historically hate, it's sort of overt spread of hate, as well as the looking the other way, is historically a province of the right wing in the United States and around the world. And that doesn't mean, just because one side tends to do it first and tends to do it worse, doesn't mean that everyone is free of guilt. And that sort of that habit of always pointing the finger and saying, oh, well, they're worse, so then I don't look at myself, was also something I was hoping to tackle. But it was very much to get us to see hate, in its various forms, from overt to unconscious, from Islamophobia to anti-Semitism to misogyny to hyper-partisanship, and to recognize the ways in which it infects not just them, but us.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking about the a situation in the UK at the moment with the British Labour Party, which is a left-wing party, and this assumption that prejudice is pretty much systemically a right-wing thing, but they are having a real issue at the moment with anti-Semitism within that party, and in fact, several members of the party have actually left to form a new group. This is news in the US at the moment. But so there's one example. And also, I couldn't agree more what you were saying about thinking that it's other people that are the hateful ones. We actually, in our society, we ran a retreat last year entitled Working with Prejudice, which is based on the assumption that we're all prejudiced to varying degrees. Uh-huh. But it's arguably that very recognition that is often the starting point, to perhaps mitigate it. And this is obviously something you really endorse in your book too. But back to your earlier question, what else can we do? For example, you talk about connection speech, connection spaces, connection thinking, and connection systems. Could you unpack them a little bit for us, Sally?
Yeah, so, in my book, literally and figuratively, the opposite of hate is not love. You don't have to love someone to stop hating them. So it's good news for everyone. The opposite of hate is actually connection. It's and we know this from research. It's the experiencing the other as finding that common ground, that connection, that even if it's not common ground, it's common sense of humanity, that they are deserving of respect, equality, dignity, all of the basic rights and justice that you are, and that we know that people tend to increase their sense of the equality and dignity of the other when they actually know them, right? I mean, this was in the United States in more modern history. We knew that the more people personally knew someone who is lesbian or gay, they increase the more their support for lesbian and gay rights increased. More recently, we know the same. We have the same statistics to prove that around trans folks. The more people personally know someone who's trans, the more their support for transgender rights increases. And yet, at least I only know the statistics in this case in the United States, but 3/4 of white Americans say they don't have any non-white friends. 53% of Americans don't know anyone who's Muslim, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We still have massive problems with segregation in our housing, in our schools, and across the board, segregation in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of partisanship, et cetera. And knowing people is part of what demystifies and unravels some of the stereotypes and unconscious and conscious bias. And it's not the only thing, and it's not the thing that solves it across the board, but it is one thing we know makes a huge dent. And so that's why it's important to have policies that apart from the fact that it's morally important to have policies that treat people equally, part of the reason why it's important you have police treating people equally is so that you're not perpetuating that kind of disparate treatment and segregation in our society. Part of it's why we need policies that pay people equally, et cetera, et cetera. And it's why, you know, as we work down to the more interpersonal level, it's why it's important that we do everything from read books from a variety of authors to live in diverse neighborhoods, to work with and hire inclusively. That those things matter, again, not just for their moral imperative, but because they are, practically speaking, small but significant ways we chip away at hate.
I'm just thinking, actually, it's like you first came to my attention through your involvement with the Forgiveness Project in the UK. And within their organisation, they often describe forgiveness as the F word due to its challenging nature. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on forgiveness, because this seems a critical aspect of engaging with hatred.
Part of the problem in our world right now is that our perspective on anything that is said or done is kind of cut through the lens of who is saying or doing it. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, we are outraged when, quote unquote, the other side says or does something.
Yeah.
But our understanding, make excuses, explain away when we or someone on our side does that. And this is what we might call hypocrisy. And it's really running rampant. And certainly, especially now, we're seeing it in the United States with partisanship, that, you know, the sort of, same sorts of things. Again, putting aside for a second which side does it first and which side does it worse, which I think is a, to a point, valuable argument. And I'm happy to have that argument. Yeah. The fact is that there are things in the United States where when someone on the right or a Republican says them, people on the left explode. And if someone on the left says arguably or similarly the same thing, people make excuses. And that happens for us, too. When someone says something that offends us, we're outraged, we are condemning, we are all those things. And when we say something that is offensive or hurtful, we make excuses, we want to be forgiven. Yeah. And so forgiveness has to be something. Look, I happen to believe redemption is a core value is a core progressive value, to be honest, but it's a core spiritual value, the idea that people can grow and change. And again, as coming at this very much as a leftist, the notion of being a leftist or being a progressive is that, in fact, things can change and evolve and grow and get better. And that has to also mean that people can change and grow and evolve and get better. And I think we still believe that. Philosophically, I think practically speaking, though, we tend to see people as rather ossified. And we, you know, in the words of Bryan Stevenson, we treat people as though they're the worst thing they've ever done, or the worst thing they've ever said, or the worst thing they've ever thought. And so I think reinvigorating a spirit of generous forgiveness, which doesn't have to run counter to holding people accountable.
Yeah.
But, you know, being able to envision that the only way the world is going to change is if people change, and that means we have to be a part of that change and what that looks like. And then, you know, the thing I know, because of having talked to ex-terrorists and ex-neo-Nazis and people who participated in genocide, is people are never hated into changing. They're never, people can change. It happens. It happens a lot. I know people in my own life who are less hateful today than they were 20 years ago. nobody was hated into changing.
That makes me think of someone you interviewed in your book, Arno Michaelis, who was an ex-white supremacist and lead singer of a hate thrash metal band. And I've actually interviewed him a couple of times, Sally, and I find him a very inspiring figure. One thing that really struck me with him, with a comment he made, one of the many things, but was how exhausting hatred was for him to maintain. It said constantly actually having to fight all this disconfirmatory evidence, you know. It said it didn't happen overnight, but it was a wearing down process.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of beautiful quotes about how hate, ostensibly that say, and this is throughout time, throughout religions, throughout philosophies, that say that hate is a burden to the hated. And that is not to, by any means, hate is a burden to those being hated as well as those who are doing the hate. And it's not to minimize the burden on those who are the objects of the hate. But it is a, it is an isolating, ugly, negative, spiritually draining, socially, draining reality. And especially in a time when we are thankfully, slowly and perfectly, but still moving away from that. But again, unfortunately, it still thrives, and it still thrives across the board. And if I wanted to, I can go find a, way to bond, right? Bond over any kind of hate I want, whether it's, sorry, that's my barking dog in the background. I don't know if you picked that up. Anytime a leaf falls, my dog triggers her anxiety. I can find a way to bond around hate, and whether that's, the conventional kinds we're talking about, or whether that's just going and bonding and hating Donald Trump. So there's lots of, there's also, the problem is there's a lot of negative sort of social reinforcement for hate too. And we have to become a force in our groups and in our countries and our governments and our businesses and our book clubs and our schools. We have to become forces that push in the direction of compassion, kindness, and connection. And it has to be deliberately so.
Sure. Just to get a sense of perspective here, if we look at history, how are we doing on the hate front? Have we made moral progress, or are there more systemic structures in place in society that guard us against more hateful behaviors?
This is a tough one, right? I mean, there's no question overall we're less hateful as a world than we once were, I suppose. But every example I could say, okay, we ended the slave trade. Yes, but we still have people who are abducted and enslaved. And usually, those people are abducted and enslaved not merely because of economic greed and opportunity, abysmal enough though those are, but in part because of some function of ethnicity or caste or something that is, there's an element of those people being dehumanized and treated as less than human, or it's women, or right. And so, here's the thing. Like, I think it's been, throughout history, there have been more hateful moments, perhaps. Maybe we are better in some regards and not in others. And it doesn't matter. It's bad enough right now for us to do something about it. And to me, that sort of, it's a version of fixating on my enemy or my opponents are worse than I am, or history was worse than I am. Like, okay, pat yourself on the back. You're not the worst. Fine. Now, what are you going to do? And you, like, about your own hate, how are you going to interrogate the, big and small ways, consciously and unconsciously, in your life that you are treating, perceiving, acting as though certain groups of people are less than you? Because I guarantee, what we could debate those other questions forever, but what we can be sure of is that everyone is doing that to some extent, somehow.
No, I would agree with that. I suppose for me, that my interest in that perspective is again about this idea of change, is that when we look back on at history, I just think about, say, the lot of women, and I think about my mum, you know, she had to go out to work when she was 14. That was her lot, you know, that a lot of her aspirations were weren't valid because she was just a young woman. And that, obviously, those things have changed to a large extent. And to me, that's when we look back at history and see at times we've made slow progress, but we have made progress. And that gives me the motivation in many ways to try to, because as you say, you know, we're nowhere near there yet. We've got a long way to go. But history can be a useful tool to indicate that, yes, that we can change for the better.
Yes. Yes. I mean, yes. And if we want to, we can look at so many examples. Again, I mean, this is why I wrote a book, not with current neo-Nazis and current terrorists and, people embroiled in the middle of genocides, but rather people who had come out the other side. Because honestly, if people can be that hateful at the what we would all agree to be the extremes of hate and come out the other side, then good God, there's hope for the rest of us.
Exactly. Yeah. No, very inspiring, actually, to see the change that can happen in people. What has been the general response to the book, Sally, and what impact has the writing of it had on you?
It's just nice to be part of sparking a conversation. I obviously, as a writer, anytime you hear about how your writing has touched people, moved them to think about their own bigotry or bias, that is heartwarming. That's all you can hope for, to get people to look at and think about the world differently. And I think this is an incredibly important conversation. I'm just honored to be, I think, a piece of, larger communities of folks who are engaging in this, you know, because it's, again, it's true that it's a phenomenon of human history. There has been hate forever. But how we hate, who we hate, it's not predestined. It's not in our DNA. It does not have to be who we are. And there is also plenty of evidence to the contrary. And that evidence includes the rising communities of writers and others working to fight back.
Yeah. I think if I reflect on my experience in life, Sally, I was certainly more prone to hatred when I was younger. It's not that I'm not susceptible to it now, especially if I'm, under-resourced or if I'm irritable or whatever, I can make a quick snap judgment that doesn't take in the full complexity of the situation or the person. But I'm a lot better at it now than I was when I was younger, partly through perhaps just age, although I don't think it's a given that as you get older that you become wiser. But also for me, what's has been helpful is practices like meditation and critical thinking, where, so when I do get emotionally hijacked, I can actually sit with it rather than just run with it, if you see what I mean.
Yes, yes. No, that's right. There's in fact even evidence that, the more that meditation and even just being well rested makes us less likely to make, sort of these unconscious, hateful leaps. Very much so.
Okay. Final two questions, Sally.
Yeah.
The middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things. That then throws us back on experience. So we're left in the sort of messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can perhaps actually get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, look, I want to be careful because I am not a third wayer in the sense of the United States politics of suggesting that, well, if we could just all move through the political middle, everything would be fine. I am a partisan.
Yeah, and we're so,
I know. But, I am a partisan. I you know, believe fervently and passionately in a set of progressive left political, you know, ideals and views. And at the same time, I also believe that we have more in common than we realize. We are overly wedded to emphasizing, and this is kind of the cultural and political moment we're in, we emphasize our differences more than our common ground. We, you know, as I said sort of earlier, we are more likely to defend and praise our side and to attack and demean the other side, regardless of the circumstances. And I think that finding, look, an increased awareness of what we have in common, of the fundamental goodness, good intent, when we can find it, and sort of an emphasis on that, and just coming to have those experiences. Look, you know, one of the things I loved writing about were the times when people who were expected to hate each other ended up getting to know each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, it didn't change necessarily their political views, but it changed their sort of sense of that their identity was inherently at odds with the identity of another human being, which just isn't true. And that's the problem. It's like, that in fact, our existence is, it's the opposite. Our existence is bound up together. And I think that understanding that in various forms, experiencing it both philosophically, spiritually, as well as practically, is, I hope, the path to liberation.
Well, I think we've got, perhaps not dissimilar to your situation in the States, we've got an opportunity in the UK with Brexit, because it's, you know, it's split families. It's an extremely divisive, perhaps the most divisive event in UK history since the Second World War. So me and my partner personally, we know people in our community that they're on the other side of the fence. So we really try and make an effort to go out and have a drink and have a good time. And I suppose an ideal friendship is where you've got that balance right between reassurance and challenge. But sometimes friendships, maybe you need to nurture them a bit more on the reassurance side before you can do a bit more of the challenging. So we've got a couple of friendships like that at the moment, but we're really pleased, you know, and we've seen each other's humanity and not demonizing each other, if you know what I mean.
No, that's exactly right.
Last question: if people wanted to find out more about your work, Sally, how would they go about it?
That is super easy. Sally Kohn, KOHN.com, or at Sally KOHN across all the different media.
Okay, well, that's great. And I think it's really important work what you're doing, Sally. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Well, ditto. Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.